You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
They say I'm old school, but I don't really believe that old school is Melly Melanin to me.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we bring you an interview with Melk D. Melk, along with his brother Giz, made up The Audio 2. The group released their first single in 1986, but found massive success the following year with the hit Top Villain. That song's influence cannot be overstated. It's been sampled or interpolated by artists such as the Notorious B.I.G., Jay-Z, Kanye West, Talib Kweli, 50 Cent, Dr. Dre, and countless others. The group would go on to release two full-length albums before disbanding, and Melk also played an integral role in the early career of his sister, the legendary MC Lyte. After the disbanding of The Audio 2, Melk went on to have a successful career as a rapper and producer, working on massive hits for artists like Jason Downs and Eamon. We talked to Melk at the Rap Genius office in Brooklyn. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special sort of audio footnotes to go along with the episode. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL40. The first result will bring you annotated interview excerpts, audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. Now here's our talk with Melk D. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, same Milk old song. Here with Melk D.
What more can I say? Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah.
All right.
Nice. So, first off, before you came here, we had you on Rap Genius, on your new verified account.
Yeah, and that was wonderful. It looks really cool. I'm going to start messing with it, playing with it.
Excellent. So we got to see your thoughts on Audio 2 stuff and some songs that have sampled or interpolated, your biggest hit, Top Villain. Just for folks who might not know, can you give us a little rundown of who you are?
I am Milk D of Audio 2, one half of Audio 2. They say I'm old school, but I don't really believe that old school is Melly Melanin to me. I might be middle school. Best known for Top Villain, most people know that, but we have a lot of music in the atmosphere.
Excellent. Nice. And so Audio 2 was a duo.
Yes, me and my brother.
Was you and your brother. But the odd thing about the duos I was listening to was like you guys were rarely on songs together.
Right. Giz was the DJ. You know how it was back in the days. He's a MC and a DJ, so he's a DJ.
He was a DJ.
Yeah.
Nice. But when he was rapping, would you guys give any thought to, like, which songs you wanted his voice on or yours or, like...
Sometimes we would just get ideas and be like, oh, Giz, Giz should do this one. But rapping really wasn't his thing. It was more my thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were saying before off camera that you started out super young.
Yeah. My first record came out when I was 14. It was called A Christmas Rhyme. It was a Christmas record on an independent label. Then we had another, we called it the Flip Flop Mini Album, which came out when I was 15. That was our first release on our label, First Party Music. And then Top Billing came out in 86 when I was 16.
Rap Beast.
Yeah.
And then the actual Audio 2 album didn't come out for a while after
88.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, it took a, believe it or not, and this, I guess, I don't know if you're going to ask this, but when we released Top Billing in 86, everybody rejected it. All of the DJs said it was whack. We actually released Top Billing and Light Song, I Cram to Understand You, at the same time. This was, you know, we were brand new and we just kept, we pushed, it took us a year. We pushed both of those songs for a year before we got any response. And, you know, look at it now. They said it would never work. I sounded like a girl. Light sounded like a boy.
Right, which is such an odd thing to say about both of you.
Yeah, there's no music. It's just a beat. The rhyme was corny. And what is it, 30 years later?
Rap Beast.
Yeah. Well, I'm... So Cram and Cram to Understand You and Top Billing were released at the same time?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
What was that? So I've read different things in different places. What exactly is the relationship between you and Light?
My sister.
Is your sister.
Yeah,
okay.
Giz is my brother.
Okay.
And Nat Robinson is our father.
Is your I was going to ask about that, because the music business is a family business for you. Your father
yes.
is involved and even had a cameo on one of your records.
Yeah. Hickeys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what was the story behind that? Did he encourage you to get involved in the business? Or
my father is an entrepreneur, and he's been, you know, he's had businesses and did a whole lot of things before we started with the music. He was one of the biggest club promoters in the 70s. He had all these big clubs. If he sees that you're taking something serious and you're showing initiative, then he'll support you. And he saw how much... I started rapping when I was 9. So, you know, I was doing demos and submitting stuff. There was a radio station in Brooklyn. I forget the actual station, but it was at Medgar Evers College. And they used to have this show where you would submit your demo and they would play the demo. And then people would call and vote on it. And... you know, I made this demo. Actually, there was a, they had this contest about, write a rhyme about New York and submit it. So the first time I ever went to the studio, King of Chill, which a lot of people know who he is, he took me to this guy named Richard Lee studio. He's from a group called Clear. They had that song, Intimate Connection, for people that might know that. So we went there and we recorded the demo for the contest. I submitted it to the contest and, you know, it didn't win. But I also submitted it to the radio station at Medgar Evers and they started playing it. So they started playing it and before you know it, it was like number one. This is like a real small little station. Number one, and I was listening, you know, every Friday night or whatever, and it was like number one for weeks and weeks. So I, you know, I told my father, I'm like, look, they're playing it. And he was like, all right, well, I, you know, basically I see that you're serious about this. And his friend, who was also a club promoter, had started an independent label. And he talked to him. And that's where we released A Christmas Rhyme. But basically the situation with A Christmas Rhyme was, although it was his friend's label, we were basically doing all of the work. And my father was funding everything. So it was like, we might as well start our own label. Yeah, so that's what we did. And, you know, the rest is history.
Right. And so what was it like for you to see Light succeed so much and blow up first with Cram and then with her first album?
It was great. We were having so much fun. I knew, you know, when everybody was saying she sounded like a boy and she was too tough, I knew what it was. And I knew that she was going to be big. And I knew that it wasn't anything else like her or what we were doing out. And I knew it was going to be big. So when it started picking up steam, it made me happy. And it's like, okay, I knew it.
Yeah.
You know?
She was pretty young too, right?
Same age. She's 6 months younger than me. We have different mothers. Yeah.
Okay. That's amazing. And, I've noticed, you know, if you listen to stuff that both of you were doing back then. There are similarities, I think, in your styles and rhymes and things like that. So you were growing up together, kind of learning to rap at the same time.
And when you spend a lot of time in the studio, things rub off. And with Light, I was mostly took the role as producer. So for a lot of it, I was guiding her. Even though I didn't have to guide her too much, I just had to inspire her. Like, come on, kick that shit. That's it.
Yeah.
Just kick that shit. Like, yeah, that's hard. And I was the one that was telling her, when she'd be like, wow, that's a little rough. You think it's too rough? And I'd be like, nah, it's not rough at all. That's perfect.
Yeah. Excellent. And so on that first album, you know, you're wearing red and white on the cover. You have that line on When the Two is on the Mic about, you know, wearing red and white. Was that color scheme your idea, your dad's? Like, where'd that come from?
I think we just grew into it. I always used to wear red, me and Giz, and then one day we just decided that that's what we were going to wear. We're going to always wear the red baseball hats. And if nothing else, the red baseball hats. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it just happened.
Nice. Yeah. That's very, very cool. And I think a lot, you know, I like Cherries. It's just such, it's such a fun song, such a funny one, and kind of bizarre. And I was wondering if you could talk about that one a little bit. So you wrote that when you were about 14, 15, right?
Yes. That was the Flip Flop mini album, which I talked about earlier. That was one of the songs that was on there. We ended up using it on the album again. My whole concept, the story of my life, basically, but the whole concept of what we did was we always wanted to do something different. So if it was different or unique, then I would be happy. So that was our attempt of doing a bugged out song that nobody else would do. And it's so funny because when I listen to I Like Cherries now, I cringe. I'll be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. And it seems like nowadays I get so many emails and so many people talking about that song more than ever. Like, these is, you know, even the fact that you're asking me this question.
Yeah.
But that was just us being different. And, you know, at the time, I think it might have been too bogged out for people. But nowadays, people kind of like the fact that it was different.
Rap Genius.
And someone else who was involved in the Audio 2 album and in the process was Daddy-O of Stetsasonic, right? How did he get hooked up with it?
Daddy-O was our mentor. I don't even remember where I met Daddy-O, but once we met, you know, we clicked. And I used to, I was a big Stetsasonic fan. All of them, Prince Paul, everybody. So he started coming over to my studio, which, by the way, when I say studio, I'm talking about a cassette 4-track. You know what I mean? Not a real studio.
Right.
A cassette 4-track. A lot of people don't realize that, too. All of those original first-party music songs, Top Billing, I Cram to Understand You, that was recorded on 4-track cassette in my basement.
What were you using for drums?
I had a foot pedal sampler triggered by a Roland 707 drum machine. So I had, like, I would just sample the drums or whatever and then play it, trigger it with the 707 and record it right to the, because you couldn't, it didn't have a disc. So whatever you were working on, you had to record it right away. Otherwise, you would lose it. And record the beat on the one track of the 4 tracks. That song, actually, that track.
So you had to play the beat through the whole time.
Right, for whatever, 3 minutes. Wow. The Top Billing's 2:59. But however long you thought that you wanted the song, it's not like now where you can change it afterwards. It's like, it's pretty set then. And, So Daddy would come to the studio and, you know, he was short. And I would go to the studio. I think that's probably where I met him. We used to work at the studio called Calliope. And Daddy-O used to work, Stet used to work there also. But he would come over, he would show me things. And most people don't realize that they think that Daddy-O did the beat for Top Billing. But he didn't. I did the beat for Top Billing. But Daddy-O is a producer of the song in the traditional sense that the producer of a song is the person that makes the decision. And I'll never forget, I did that song, you know, late one night, and Daddy-O came over the next day and I played it for him, and he was like, yo, no, this is the one right here. And he was like, this is the song, this is a hit. If Daddy-O would have never said that, the song probably would have never been released, because it was just something I was messing around with. But he was like, this is it, this is the one. So, you know, then he, you know, did the pullouts. And so that's production sometimes. Sometimes production is saying, this is it. Leave it just like that. And that was, you know, his contribution, his valuable or invaluable contribution to that.
Rap and beans. So the first people to sample that was you guys, right?
Right. And it's funny, I'm glad you said that, because my theory, I don't know if I should be saying this, but I think that part of the reason why so many people sample it is because we started sampling it. The next single was I Don't Care, which is I Don't Care from Top Billing. And we sampled our own stuff so much, I almost feel like it kind of got the people in the habit of hearing it. It's just my theory. Yeah. And that might be the reason why people sample it so much, or part of the reason, or the initial seed of that thought.
Mm. Yeah. When did you first really start to notice, wow, this is taking off, I'm hearing people using this in a lot of songs?
It seemed immediately. So, like, it was released, we released the eight, well, I guess not immediately, we released the single with 86, but like I said, it took us a year, almost 2 years to break it. The album came out in 88. So by 88, I had already started hearing people, you know, quoting lyrics and, you know, little samples here and there that you wouldn't get paid for. But the first actual on the record sample was Real Love, which came out in like 90 or 91. So it was like a 2 or 3 year thing of seeing it. That's when I realized it started, but I had no idea. And to this day, I can't believe, you know, how much of an impact, how much influence, and how many times it's been sampled. It's not just the samples.
Right, it's the interpolations.
Yeah, so and also the vibe and the concept. That was really, you know, that was probably the first song or one of the first songs that only contained a beat and a rhyme. You know, it kind of made it, you know, made the way, made people feel comfortable just rhyming over beats, you know.
That's
the rhyme style. You know, when I hear MCs from Brooklyn, I hear it. I can hear
even now
the influence of what we did. You know, some people might deny it or they may not agree, but I can hear it. I can hear the sound. Even, you know, Biggie told me how much I influenced them. And I could hear it in his, I'm no Biggie, but I can hear the influence. And I guess, you know, that's probably the reason why he used it.
Yeah.
So many times.
Well, he obviously was quite the scholar, right? He did that whole, basically, like a Schoolie D cover on his second album and all that stuff.
And he used it on the intro of the first album. He used Top Billing as 2 minutes and 59 seconds. He played 2 minutes and 40 seconds of the song in his intro.
Right.
So, you know, if that's any indication of the influence.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, after the Audio 2 days, you did a bunch of producing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of your hugest hits was the Eamon song, right?
Eamon,
I'm sorry.
I Don't Want You Back.
Yeah. What was the deal with that? Because it seems such an unlikely hit, mostly because of the language. For folks who might not know, the song is called Fuck It, right? Fuck It, I Don't Want You Back. And there's plenty of cursing in the tune, yet somehow it managed to become a huge hit all over the world.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just say this. That was my biggest hit ever to date. You know, we sold 6 million copies on the album. It was number one played in the world in that year, right above Usher. The so that was my biggest hit sales wise. You know, most popular for top billing, but that's my biggest hit. Yeah. Fuck It, I Don't Want You Back. It's just a continuation of what I've always done, which is what we talked about earlier. I gravitate towards unique, different things. Things that people say will never work, that's what I want to do. Right. I'm not that cat that tries to do what everybody else is doing, or, you know, I can't even get into that, imitating other people or trying to do. So that's just a continual, I Don't Want You Back is just my production version of Top Billing for somebody else. Most people don't know, and I don't think I see it on your paper over there. Even before I Don't Want You Back, I had an artist named Jason Downs.
What I was going to ask about that is both songs are funny.
Mm-hmm.
And you tie that into, like, I Like Chariots and the Hickey's tune and all that. I feel like there's this kind of thread of, like, you not being afraid of being funny. And I was just curious about that. Like, were you, like, a funny dude in school?
I guess I am, right?
Yeah.
I look at it as just not being scared to do something unique or creative. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun doing that song, White Boy with a Feather. That was Jason Downs. And we had a lot of success with that. My whole concept with that was, this is country hip-hop, and I'm going to do hip-hop the way that I do it and incorporate, you know, a white dude, country white dude. And the whole concept about the song was that he came to New York. He was a country dude. I don't know. Did you listen to the song?
Yeah.
So it was like, it was just a concept that I thought nobody else would do. So we did it. I Don't Want You Back. Eamon wrote those lyrics. He came to me and he's like, yo, I wrote this song. And because he broke up with this girl, and that's how he is. And I was the cat that was like, yo, this is the one. Like, I was the daddy-o in this situation. I was like, yo, this is the one. We have to do this one. And the funny thing is, we shopped that song to a lot of labels, and they were like, oh, this is a hit song, but we could never get it played, and they would pass. But Barry Weiss, who I believe is very similar to me, or I'm similar to him, the way that he thinks, he saw the vision.
He is one of the top people at Jive, right?
Right. He's not at Jive anymore, but he was Jive, basically. He had faith in it, and we released it, and it blew up instantly. Like, 1 month, it had already started blowing up, and, you know, it was big. But to me, it wasn't anything different than what I always did. It's the same thing, just a different artist.
Right. What is it like to ride that wave? I'm so curious about that, because a few weeks ago I talked to the author Adam Mansbach, who writes these, you know, serious novels about, like, you know, jazz and hip-hop and race in America and all these weighty things. But he also wrote Go the Fuck to Sleep.
Uh-huh.
Right? He writes this, like, mock children's book that gets him on the Today Show. And I'm just curious about, like, you know, you do your thing and you're comfortable with it and you've got your audience, and then you do a thing that just goes into the stratosphere. Like, it hits the culture in some way that it's just ready for and just explodes. And I'm just curious, you know, I got what that was like for him. I'm curious what that was like for you with the Eamon thing.
I, you know, like I said, it's the same thing. To me, my life, my career is the same story over and over again. You know, they said Todd Billing wouldn't work. It did. They said Jason Downs wouldn't work. It did. They said MC Light wouldn't work. They said Eamon wouldn't work. So to me, it wasn't really an extension. You know, it wasn't anything different. It was the same thing. You know, a lot of times, not all the time, but sometimes pop music becomes pop just because the artist is white. Like, I Don't Want You Back isn't any more pop than Top Billing. Obviously, Top Billing is a pop song also, but Eamon being white kind of makes it a little more pop. Mm-hmm. And it opens it up to more people. But other than that, it's the same thing to me. You know, it's it. I expected it to do what it did and more. Right. You know, so
that's incredible, man. It's really great. I wanted to talk about, you've done a duet with one of the Beastie Boys, right? With Ad Rock. With Ad Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious about working with him because you guys, your approach and, or your voice at least, is pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would assume that he probably took a fair amount from you stylistically, or maybe you started
They came out before we did.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, I'm, you know, especially then, I was the biggest Rick Rubin fan as a producer, and Run DMC fan, and Beastie Boys fan. So, you know, I was even honored to even be working with him from jump. That album was, that EP was on Rick Rubin's label, American. It started out as Deaf American, and it became American. Basically, what happened is, you know, with basically when our time was up at Atlantic, which was basically, I knew the time was up when they started telling me, you know, you need to do a song like Heavy D. And that's, like I said earlier, that's not what I do. I don't do songs like other people. I do what I do. If you don't get it, then, you know, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Or you don't even have to get it. If you're not willing to support it, then, you know. So that's when I knew that time was over. I never spoke to Rick Rubin. I called him. And like 6 hours later, he called back. And I was like, listen, you know, somebody had told me that he was a fan of mine. So, or of ours. So I called him, and he called back, and I told him we were leaving Atlantic, you know, and I wanted to be on his label. And then he was like, he would be honored. I was like, bet. So that was it. Another crazy thing is, he sent me my advance, everything. We didn't have any contracts whatsoever. I found out later that he was a big fan of ours. But anyway, that's how the whole Ad Rock thing came into play. And what's even more funny is, Ad Rock and Rick had beef. Like, beef.
Coming back to the Def Jam.
Oh, man. He cursed. When we was in the studio, he cursed Rick so much. And he was just like, yo, the only reason I'm doing this is because of you. You know, fuck Rick and all of that. So, you know, that was kind of bizarre. You know. But I was influenced a lot by the Beastie Boys. Mm-hmm. So it was easy and it was comfortable. I like Beastie Boys because, you know, like I told you, they basically stood for what I stand for. Or, you know, maybe it rubbed off on me. They just did what they did. And most people said it would never work. And it took a long time before it worked. And they just did what they did. And the more unique or obnoxious or whatever it is, the better it was.
Yeah.
So we were very similar like that. So, I'd like to do something else with them in the future. I think I'm going to try and set that up.
Excellent. And what kind of music were you listening to at the time you started, like, rapping out, or two started popping off? Because you have that Make It Funky where you have the James Brown sample and all that. And it's a little, the sample's a little deeper in James Brown's catalog than most people.
So to be honest, I am a lover of music. I listen to everything, especially back then. These days, I listen to a lot of older music, but I love everything. At that time, I was listening to a lot of James Brown, a lot of Oscar Brown Jr., who I'm a huge fan of. I think part of my rap style comes from him. You know who he is?
I don't.
Okay, Oscar Brown Jr., he made a song called Signifying Monkey, which is one of the best songs ever. You could Google it.
Yeah.
I'll let you hear it. I have it on my Spotify.
Yeah.
At Motown, if you listen to those original, the original first party, there was a lot of Motown samples in there and James Brown. But I listen to everything, and Beastie Boys and Run DMC. But like I said, I started rapping when I was 9. My idol was Kumo D. And Treacherous 3 and Grandmaster Caz and Cold Crush Brothers. I used to listen to those mixtapes.
Yeah.
The battle mixtapes. And that's when I heard that Kumo D Busy Bee Battle, that's when I decided that I wanted to rhyme. That's what really, you know, inspired me to start rapping.
Rap Genius.
I believe it. I mean, the amount of times I've heard Kaz's name come up with the artists I've talked to is astounding.
Yeah, and him, it's mostly him, but his group, and it's the same thing with Kumo D. It's mostly Kumo, but the group
the other
also.
Guys Treasures 3 also.
Yeah, Kumo D, even to this day, I'm thinking about covering Go See the Doctor. It's brilliant. It's like, who thinks like that when they write? You know, Kumo D is that guy. He's so underrated, but I'll always, you know, I always say that he inspired me.
Definitely. Real quick, I wanted to, you know, you've talked a bunch about it, but I just kind of wanted to touch on I Get Money, which is, you know, obviously a 50 Cent song that samples your voice. And just what, you know, I know you've talked about the story before. They didn't clear the sample. They had to come back to you and whatever. But just what were you, or they hadn't initially, right? They didn't initially clear it. And
well, yeah, go ahead, finish the
question. Oh, no, I was going to say, just how did you feel when you first heard it?
Whenever I hear a sample, I feel honored and flattered first. Like, oh, wow. And then if it's, you know, a humongous artist like 50, you know, Biggie or Mary, then it's even better. Then I'm like, wow, that's cool. So I'll never forget this. I heard it on July 4th. I don't remember the year. It might have been 2007. And I was driving to a barbecue and Flex and everybody. It was at 4th of July weekend. And they just kept playing it. And I was like, yo. I was like, wow. I was like, they didn't clear that, because usually they'll notify me first if they clear it. And I'm like, all right, well, I never had any doubt that it would be cleared.
Yeah.
And I thought they didn't clear it. And I even did a few interviews and stuff. And I said, yeah, they didn't clear it. But they did clear it. That actually, same thing happened with Otis. They had cleared it. And like Monday, you know, my company, they called and it's like, oh, they cleared. And I was like, oh, they cleared it. You know, I didn't know the splits or whatever. But then I found out afterwards that they had cleared it, which, you know, all of the smart ones, like 50, like Jay-Z and like Kanye, they clear them first. So I learned a lesson from that. let me call.
Right. Check first.
They cleared it. I felt honored and I thought the song was dope. I thought it was the perfect compliment for the song. And it's funny because, you know, a lot of cats, I mean, there's really nobody else in the position that I'm in as far as the samples. But my experience with other people that have gotten sampled, they always try and stick it to the person who sampled it. And they look at it, you know, if they don't clear it first, then they really screw them. And they try and take 100% or whatever, or just stick it to them. But to me, I look at it as a collaboration. So when I hear 50 and, you know, it's like I didn't make that beat. I didn't write 50's verses. My part is a important part in the song. It's the hook and it's there and it fits. It's a collaboration. I don't see, you know, if we split it in thirds, that seems fair to me. And I'll rock with that. I don't want 50% or 100% if my portion is a part of a collaboration. It's just like writing to me. So that's the approach that I take, and I don't try to stick it to people. So I also think that's part of the reason why they sample it so much. It's fair. If, you know, that ain't my song. You know what I mean? It's like, yo, they used it. I'm happy they used it. I'm flattered and honored. It sounds dope. It's part of the song. You know?
Awesome. And so what are you working on right now?
I'm currently being very creative, working on some new Milk music. I've gotten so much inspiration and push to do it. I'm doing it. So that's I have everything clear and I'm working on that right now. And, you know, soon, by the summertime, we'll have some Milk music out there.
Well, I look forward to hearing it and seeing it.
You'll be the first.
Seeing it broken down on Rap Genius.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was our talk with Melk D of the Audio 2. If you enjoy what you hear on Outside the Lines, visit us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. You can also leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like Melk D. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
I look at it as just not being scared to do something unique or creative.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You know, I was even honored to even be working with him.
Our theme music is by Psionic.
My whole concept with that was, this is country hip-hop.
And the creator of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice.
It took us a year, almost 2 years to break it.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at OTL_podcast and on Facebook at Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Special thanks to Guy from War Media for helping to make this episode happen.
He sent me my advance, everything. We didn't have any contracts whatsoever. I found out later that he was a big fan of ours. But anyway.
Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode of Outside the Lines, where we talk to R.A. the Rugged Man. We talk to the veteran MC about his storied past and his new album, Legends Never Die. That album is out this week, and you should definitely pick it up. See you in 2 weeks on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.
No, it's for you. I'm not gonna ask the same people, you know, questions. Silly.